This is the Amp Hour Podcast. Released September 13th, 2020. Episode 508, sponsored by Mouser Electronics. Doom to the Flatland.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
We're talking about things we don't miss doing.
Yeah.
I was just mentioning you sounded just before the show, you sounded like you were like dead asleep.
Dead to the world, yeah.
Dead to the world, and tell us why.
Well, I spend a lot of the day, like, you know, placing 0402 components with tweezers, and, you know, it's part of the job, and yeah, it's just, so here's the positive of it. Like, I get to listen to podcasts all the time. I listen to the interview with Lewis. I thought that was great. It's nice from a catch-up, kind of turn my brain off point of view, but my brain's off. So that's why I've been a little low energy today, you know. So, yeah.
That is a great way to listen to podcasts. I mean, I haven't, sat in front of and built, like, spent, you know, 10 hours under a Mantis microscope for quite some time now, so that is something I do not miss.
Yeah, it's low effort enough that you can, like, you can actually listen to stuff and not, like,
you can tune out. That's right.
Yeah,
whereas most stuff, like, if I'm working at the computer or something, I can't be listening to a podcast. It's too distracting, you know. It's like, but yeah, something like that I could certainly, but I just don't do it enough to, you know, be able to listen to podcasts like you do.
Well, podcast fiend. Basically that, and so, like, my podcast times are walking the dog,
right,
who just looked up at me, he's like, what? Time to go. Cleaning the house, driving, but I don't do that anymore, and then like soldering things, and that's
driving, you know. Another thing I don't miss.
I don't miss that at all.
So
travel too. So, like, you know, I just got back from travel, and, like, I don't miss traveling. Like, here's the thing I miss. I miss, like, going to conferences and meeting nerds and, like, hanging out and geeking out over, like, boards and stuff like that. But if they were all in my hometown, like, sign me up. Like, I don't want to get on planes and stay in hotels and, like, be away from home and my wife and just, like, you know, I want to just be in my stuff, you know, I, like, want to be here. And so I don't miss the travel part. Was nice, of course, you know, especially when, like, companies paid for it. But
it's better when you're younger. But people say, before the whole COVID thing, why don't I come to here? You know, go to the US, go to Europe. It's like, do you realize how long it is?
But you never do it. So, I mean, like, I think they're saying do it once. Yeah, you want. Yeah, you used to. Yeah. No, but yeah, it's a huge thing.
No, basically, since I had kids, it's just not a, you know, isn't a thing that I really look forward to doing. I'll hop on a plane, I'll go to, you know, a trade show in Melbourne, or I'll go to a thing, you know, a conference at Queensland or something like that. You know, it's but I'm not going to sit on a plane for 15 hours. I'll sit on a plane for a couple of hours, no, don't miss it.
Well, I don't blame you on that one, but it's too bad. It's really too bad that the, you know, the one thing I thought was going to come out of the whole, you know, quarantine pandemic thing was going to be, like, better VR AR technology type stuff. I haven't seen anything that, like, has improved like the in-person meeting kind of.
No, it's still dodgy experience. Skype and Zoom.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It's still, like, with the crappy grainy webcam garbage, you know.
Well, not all. I mean, you and I can, you know, we can do better.
We can do better. Yeah,
but
exactly.
Most people, yeah.
Yeah, it's just garbage, and people have no idea how to, like, you know, half their heads chopped off or their, you know, they have no idea how to frame a camera and, jeez.
I had a fun experience with that over the weekend. I was talking to my family, and, like, I have nephews and a niece, and so I was talking to my parents on their iPad, and it was, like, on, like, the table as, like, you know, they had, like, put out, like, snacks for, like, the family that was all showing up there, and I was talking to them. And then, like, my niece comes into the frame. She, like, shows up and comes into the frame, and there's, like, cheese and crackers on the table there, and she's just, like, this giant, like, just eating, inhaling cheese right into the camera just because of the angle it is.
Right. People have zero awareness for Zero camera awareness. Yep.
Yeah. I still think, I think there's, you know, we made that joke on here a long time ago about like the idea of like a teddy bear with like a, you know, a face on it.
Oh, God, yes.
That was like a long time ago.
I'm
going
to do the telly bear or something. What was it called?
Yeah, whatever it was called.
Telepresence bear or something. Yeah. Yeah. So you could sit the bear in the conference room and you could telepresence with the, yeah, we're going to. We were semi-serious about that, weren't we? It was an April Fool's joke.
An April Fool's joke or some silliness. But like, there is still like, I don't know, telepresence is so creepy to me, but it's still like, it still sucks, you know? It's still like wanting to be able to just, even just be able to manipulate the camera, move it around. Like in that scenario where like, I don't want someone to have to move the camera around while there's, you know, a bunch of my family members in like one room. It's not a huge room. They're not all sitting at the end of a table. I would like to be able to actually like, move my head around and be able to like, you know, that it just tracks the motion or something like that. It doesn't have to move. I don't have to like have a VR headset on or something like that. Literally just being able to pan a camera around would be nice, but you know, it's not even great
in science fiction. You know, if you watch like various like science fiction movies and shows and stuff, it's like, it's not even that great in those.
Right. Yeah. Like Ready Player One, maybe, but like,
yeah. Oh yeah, okay, but that's, you know, that's a full, like, that's helmet.
Yeah, exactly.
Base.
Yeah.
That's like, you know,
it's like you're living in that virtual space. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So,
I think the problem is it's just like expensive. So, like, I started thinking through this too of like, well, what would it cost? So, imagine you just had like a little motorized platform for, you know, an iPad, right? So, just say you're just gonna say it's literally just like a motorized turntable, but like, what are people willing to pay to have that sort of thing? And like $100, right? It's like, okay, so now how much of that can be just pure bomb cost? And like, what, $10 maybe 20,
right?
And like, if it's a consumer level thing, then you also have to like factor in all the software that would go on top of that, and just,
and
like,
then you got to line it all up, and it's got to be like, you can't just whack it there and go, right? If you've got so, you know, if your iPad's sitting in the middle of your boardroom table and it's on this spinny thing, right? And then, you know, just think of the practicalities of that. You've got the, it's got to be lined up and framed for each person. It's got to know where each person is. Sure, you could do that in software with tracking and stuff like that. But then you've got the pan, like, you know, you're like the person watching at the other end's got this, you know, constant panning bloody thing from, as one person speaks, it's got to spin around to the, know, person who's speaking. It's like, just think of the, like, you really need like a 360 camera. You need like instant to make it.
Yeah.
Really, your people would just get seasick. I get that. Yeah. Every time I go out and do a handheld camera footage, I get people complaining about being seasick.
Oh, yeah.
Every time.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the human inner ear is not made for it.
No. Well, and some people are just like, they just can't handle anything, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yep.
And it's like, yeah, I'm actually watching the same footage going, what's the problem? I don't. And they're going, oh, it made me physically sick. It's like, you turn your steady cam on. I've got my steady cam on, you know. It's like, and you still get sick. It's like, pan slower. Okay. You know, it's like, yeah, no, you've got to, it has to be purpose designed.
Right. And then, well, then in that case, then, so then you think about, okay, well, now we need to implement like a bunch of other, you know, either control algorithms or say like a, you know, even a DJI, like a, you know, the gimbals that are out there now, like those things are fantastic technology for super cheap, you know, like they make these crazy motor driven, you know, all my camera gear obsession stuff. Like I watch these things that they just came out with a new one that's like $500, but it can like, you know, steady cam, like a, you know, 2-3 pound camera, like pretty heavy stuff. And like, but like that's $500 and that's from DJI, who's doing like high volume, you know, already got all the algorithms dialed in and stuff like that. So now you start thinking, I was like, oh man, like, all this stuff. And it's like, it really starts to come into focus why this isn't a thing yet. You know, like people aren't willing to, and maybe there are some solutions out there. I don't deny that. It's just that it's not widespread because it's a lot cheaper to just have an iPad and just have it propped up and it's just doing its thing.
I suspect that we might be doomed to that future. I mean, it's like
flatland,
right? Because I'm just thinking of the practicalities of it. It's got to be purpose designed. I can't visualize any just sort of cheap, generic push the button and go solution that will be that will be like really practical and solve all the problems.
Yeah,
I'm not seeing it.
I think it would have to tie into a, you know, an existing platform like an iPad or, you know, a
generic consumer solution would have to, yes. It'd have to use the existing ridiculously powerful tech that we already carry around in our pocket.
That's right.
Or bag, right?
Right. It's, for what? You know, $500-$600. Yeah. It's insane.
Yeah. But by limiting yourself to that, you're limiting yourself to the ability, I think. I think there's no, like, real solution. As I said, like, it's just the physics of it. How can you, unless you can whip that camera around in 0.1 of a second, how is it not going to be, you know, panning from one person to the next? Like,
it's just right.
Like, and then if two people start talking at the same time, how does the algorithm handle that? Does it suddenly zoom out and have two people talking at the same time? Because you'd want that.
You were thinking like autofollow. I was thinking like I would just have controls of it. Like literally, I would just be able to press arrow keys or something like that. Or
oh, no, of course. Yeah, you can do it manually. I'm talking about like fully automated solutions that just work, that any dumbass can use and nobody has to control. You know, it just magically sci-fi works, right?
Right, yeah. And I've seen some of that stuff. Like, so there's some conference solutions that are out there that are like that. But yeah, and they didn't work that. I mean, like, I think Samsung might have had that, and that was back in, I was there 06, 07. So like even then, they had it, and I'm sure it was very, very fancy and very expensive. But yeah, it still didn't go that great. And it's kind of disconcerting too when you're on the receiving and you're like seeing this camera like, you know, snap between different people, and you're like, oh my God, like what is it doing? You know, it's got that kind of servo.
And then they try and talk at the same time, then it snaps back and forth.
Right, right.
And it's like because with telepresence, as people no doubt aware with our show, it's like we're on the other sides of the planet. We can't see each other. There's no visual cues. We're going to talk over ourselves and guess. It's just one of those things, you know?
Right. Well, we've dialed it in, Dave. Come on, 10 years.
Oh, yeah. We're getting better, you know, we're getting okay at it, but it still happens. It's like... Oh, yeah.
Well, that's why I have an editor too, you know?
Well, yeah, exactly. That helps. But how do you do that in real time?
Like, I don't know.
You know, see?
Yeah.
There's another layer of complexity that may not be practically solvable.
Well, if it's like a steampunk future, then you have like a, you know, you have like a digital assistant that's doing that for you.
Right.
You know, the person behind the curtain or something.
Right.
So speaking of things behind the curtain, probably a bad segue, but you were also talking about this like amazing tech in our pocket. I got to see this amazing X-ray machine that my workspace has. And I got to check it out today, and one of the operators was showing me he had scanned like a Pi Zero, and like, oh man, like it was like high end, like super crazy scanning of like, you know, BGA voiding and stuff like that. And
I was
going to
say, this is a specific BGA machine, right? This is like, no, well, that's its purpose. No,
it's not even specific to BGAs. It's a full 360 degree X-ray reconstruction. And so basically you can scan in and reslice all the way through everything that's in there. And so basically you're showing me like all the contrasting you can do. And he basically like slid all the way from the top through the bottom and showed
like, that's pornographic.
It was really, really cool. I'll have to see if they're published.
How much does that cost?
My question too. He said upwards of 900K.
I was going to say it's like mid six digits. Like,
Yeah. I thought it was going to be multiple millions, but yeah, it is super cool.
Ah, right. So this is the new super low cost version at 900K. Yeah, right. Yep.
Yeah. So yeah,
and how does it move the camera or does it move the object?
It moves. So it has a rotational table. So it has like an A. Yep. I guess that's A.
Okay.
Right?
So it's moving the object. It's not spinning the camera around it. It's
right. Yeah. So he said that like. It's you have to put the object at like an odd non-orthogonal angle so that you don't, you know, so if you're looking like straight down at a part, you might have, or say the example he gave was like, if you're looking at BGAs and you're looking at it from side on, right? So like looking down the row of, you know, you might see daylight between the rows of BGAs of the balls on a BGA.
Uh-huh.
He said that's actually a bad angle because then the balls would, the front ball would basically block the any electrons from getting to the back ball or
whatever
the rays are coming in there. And so basically he showed that there's like the weird kind of angle that you're trying to do and you're trying to like rotate it at this angle and basically to get as many paths through, right? Because there's going to be basically when you're slicing through this thing, you're trying to get stuff through, right? So the metal's going to block some of it. And it's going to, some of the stuff's going to absorb it at different energies and stuff like that. So he showed this weird angle that you're doing it and then you rotate the whole thing. And that's to try and get the electrons. Is it electrons? Yeah. I don't even know. I guess it's X-rays. So it's.
Yep.
Yeah. It's photons? Not photons.
we're not physicists. Just let's not, just shut up. Lest
hand waving.
Embarrass ourselves.
Right, 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 right. Chris hand waves this way. But then it reconstructs everything, and like, oh my god, the computers that were in there to reconstruct everything. Dude, it was so cool. So
this is your shared workspace, right?
That's right. So this was actually a corporate sponsor who installed it there.
I was going to say who paid for that, because that's a huge capital expenditure. That's
very
just
big capital
like
expense.
That's what. So it's on loan, or was it bought by the?
It's like a primary use is of the person, the company that put it in there,
right?
And then there's some opportunities to use it outside of that. And I was like, ooh, okay, yeah.
So there's a big company using your shared space. They like buy a big part of your space or something, do they?
They're a corporate sponsor there. And then they basically bought enough space to be able to put this thing in there. And it is kind of closed off from most people. And there's only like a couple operators of it, but.
Oh, but yeah. Okay. So you can't just wander up. It's not for the general plebs like you to use.
That's right. Right. I'd have to go to the people that do it, ask very, very nicely and say, hey, can you please scan my board? And but yeah, it was really cool too, because I didn't actually realize that I guess it's not a SIP, but it was like whatever the module that's on like a Pi Zero, it has an internal, like a circuit board internally that reroutes all from the silicon. So the silicon goes out to bond wires. That I expected. But then it actually goes down to a second layer. The silicon kind of seemed pretty transparent to these rays, and and you know, there's different contrasts you can play with. We didn't do too much of it, but you know, you basically, depending on how you change the contrast, you could change what was actually showing up there. Obviously metal was super easy to see, but like, you know, bond wires are super tiny, and you know, gold is different than, you know, or whatever the material is that bonding there. So yeah, it was really neat though, and I'll try and get more details and see if they'll post any videos of it, because I think, you know, like that, if it is something they plan to offer as a service, that would be, you know, good promo.
Of course.
I would think. Yeah.
Now I'm interested in the company that's, you know, like sponsoring like their own space in this. Is this because it's cheaper for them than renting their own space, or I assume it's like it's got to be a financial reason that it's like cheaper for that, rather than like buy all these machines themselves, all the CNC machines, the 3D machine, you know, everything, all these X-ray things, like basically they get already by buying into this space, they get all the base stuff they need, and only if they need specific things do they then buy those for themselves. So it works out cheaper than renting their own space, renting their own employees, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's really the infrastructure too. You think about like, you know, having like this thing needs like 3-phase power, and it's just like, it's a beast of a machine. And so if you're thinking about like, oh, well, we could just put this like X-ray, this is just a guess on my part, but like we're gonna put this X-ray machine like in our office, right? So if you have like commercial office space, you might be able to get it in, the building might be okay with it, but then like plumbing in 3-phase power and all the other crap that you might need there, like that's already in M-Hub, so like no big deal there.
And they might have, the company might have just mainly like engineers working at computers or whatever, and they don't have room for like a big industrial type lab.
Exactly.
So it's cheaper to sort of rent out something like that.
Yeah. It's always interesting where sometimes you'll find like kind of more gritty office space within, like, you know, buried in the bowels of like a commercial building, you might actually have like a, you know, a gritty kind of like machine shop type thing. But it is harder to find, I think, especially if you're, you know, it's a city center. So it's not like,
oh, and if you're in a building like mine, it's simply not an option. If you're in like an A-grade commercial office building like I am, yes, I can have an electronics lab, but I can't, you know, go and install like a CNC machine in here. It's like, it's just not, you know, my lease doesn't cover that sort of stuff, and it's not conducive to, you know, this thing is like, yeah, I can't get 3-phase power. Well, no, maybe I could, but like, yeah.
Right. But then the noise and all the, you wouldn't want to put it there. You'd put it somewhere else. Yeah. I heard you and Lewis talking about this. He'd be able to maybe install it, but he'd have to do it all himself.
Well, you then need a mixed use premises. And that's what, we've been talking about this on the forum and various places about, because of course I'm moving back to my old lab, and it's basically office spaces all the way down, like turtles all the way down. Everyone's downsizing, which is really interesting. I would not be wanting to be left holding the bag on a large commercial office space at the moment. everyone I know is downsizing. So it's really interesting. Right. But yeah, we're talking about like these mixed use stuff. And generally here, like in my couple of business parks around here, it's either commercial A-grade office space like this in a big office tower where there's just no option for any sort of mechanical type stuff to happen. Maybe you could have a drill press and that's about it. Or it's like a giant, you know, big cavernous, you know, 20 meter high ceiling warehouse thing with, if you're lucky, it'll have one of those like elevated office spaces, you know, where you walk up the stairs it'll have like, you know, a crappy little 20 square meter office for a couple of desks, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And yeah, so it's either one or the other. Very rare do you get like, you know, like 80% office space and then 20%, you know, like in industrial type thing. And there is one building in this entire park that actually splits it in half almost. So you get half big ceiling concrete pit industrial type thing with the big doors, and the other half is like really A-grade office space. So you just like wander from the, you know, the dirty area to the clean area. So yeah, it's quite rare though.
Most people need either warehouse or office.
Yes, both. They don't need both. Yeah, it's us weirdos that kind of need. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but we could work in the, I mean, we could work in the dark. You know, we could work in the big the big warehouse space. I was actually remembering this.
I could, but it's terrible. Like, you know.
Oh man, like, it was so. I was actually so on the road trip I was on. We there was a song. It was a Lenny Kravitz song that came on, and it was like all these memories came flooding back to me because it was the one CD that I had in the fourth industrial bay that I was sitting back in by myself with like a single desk lamp while I was like troubleshooting a fixture, and I would have this one CD and I snuck speakers in there and I would just play this one CD over and over and over again while I was troubleshooting a basic program. And so like, you know, you hear this one song, you're like, oh God, I remember.
Is this at Samsung?
This is at AudioPack, my first co-op internship.
Oh, okay. Yeah. How long were you there? I haven't heard of that one.
Oh, that was the very first job I had. So that was January of 2004. And then I kind of stuck around. So like I did like a 7-month co-op, it's called. So it's like you actually like don't do school, you work full time.
This is part of your degree, right? This is part of like, it's a work experience component.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is actually why I chose this, that reason, and also because of the financial aid. That's why I chose the school I went to, because the co-op was such an important piece of it. You know, like the thread of my life is very similar.
Some of them don't have any. Yeah. You just do 4 years of, you know.
Yeah, they say, oh, you'll get an internship over the summer if you want to, and it's like, no.
Right.
I wanted to work. I got sold on that real early, and I wanted to work and get that experience. And goddamn, I am lucky about that, because like I just remember like I remember like talking to the engineers there, and like they would just like look at me like, what do you know, like I remember it was like a transimpedance amplifier, and like one of the mechanical engineers who was barely doing electronics, he just like rattled this off, and I'm like sitting there staring, and I'm like, oh my God, he's the best electronics person I've ever met in my life. You know?
And he's a mechanical engineer.
And I just, you know, it was just like such a level set of like how little I knew.
Yeah.
In, you know, I had had like, you know, like one or two electronics courses in college, and like all the rest were like, you know, general courses.
Yeah,
and this was like, you know, you are in the middle of it. And I highly, if there's any students out there listening, I highly, highly, highly recommend it. It's like, yeah, you're going to take a little bit longer to graduate, right? So it was a 5-year program instead of four, but like 4 is so arbitrary anyways. Like, why is it 4? Why not 2? Why not 1? You know, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's not like any reason for that. And it's like, okay, so I did an extra semester, but I also, you know, made a buttload of money. I actually kept working when I was still in school. So I would, you know, I did those 7 months, and then I actually stayed on for another 4 or 5 months. Yeah, it was great.
Wow.
And it was such a weird company too. We made like, it was just like audio amplifiers for gas masks and firefighter suits.
That's important.
Yeah, very important. Yeah.
Because you got to communicate when you're inside, you know, these gas masks, and the audio has to be good. And there's lots of challenges there.
It's true. Yeah. And I learned when I was there that the way that they used to, I was like, well, what did they do before they had like electronics and amplifiers? And one of the guys put on a mask, and then he started shouting at me, and I'm like, I can't hear you. And then he lifted up the mask and he started shouting at me again. And I'm like, that's what they did. They lifted their masks up so they could talk. He's like, yeah, that's all they could do. You know, like you want to breathe.
Exactly.
You know, you just shout it, you take a deep breath, and then you shout, and then you put the mask back on, you know? It's like, holy shit.
That reminds me of the video I've done with Doug Ford, who's the former head designer at Rode Microphones and Jans Audio. Mm, yeah. And he did a video. Well, I think we did a teardown, and then he explained the design. He tore down his own product and then explained it was the audio amplifier system and distribution system for trains. And, you know, and he explains why trains sound like this. First stop central, next stop, and he explained why it actually sounds like this. And so that was donkeys years ago. We'll have to link that one in because it's fascinating. It's a similar thing. Like you'd have that muffled sound inside the mask, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, intelligibility. So, right. So Dave Young, who was a guest, I'll link his in too. So Dave Young is like a longtime friend of mine. We met the first day of co-op. And we've known each other ever since. He's a consultant now too, and we talk like every day. He's been on the show. He was on the consultant impedance matching episodes too. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we met the first day, and the thing that we joked about on the show when he was first on here was a thing called intelligibility testing, right? That was like a big thing. But what you do is you put on a gas mask, you'd have this amplifier on there, and then literally you'd read a list of words, and it would just be like, circle the word. Bat.
Circle the word
cat. And you're just trying to get vowels through because there was no like characterization. Like these days you'd think there'd be some kind of way to like, you know, just characterize, you could characterize
some sort of DSP magic to do
that.
Yeah, right?
Exactly.
You would think it'd compensate for the acoustics of the mask or something.
Yep. But there was some requirement that was like, no, you need like 60 dB white noise. And so we'd have a speaker in the middle of the room and you'd sit on the other side of the room and circle things on paper. It was terrible. But you know, the experience was amazing overall.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's not just sticking a microphone inside a mask and, you know, Bob's your uncle.
Yeah, right.
You know, there's a lot of art and science. You could do a PhD thesis on, you know, an algorithm for that kind of thing. I mean, it's just, wow. Mm. Unbelievable.
Audio stuff, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and then like, this is, what's crazy too is like, it was like all in this one area. Oh, actually, no, never mind. My second co-op was at Bird RF, and like for the longest time, you know, I worked at this place called Bird RF, which is like they do like large RF loads and stuff like that, for load testing. And it was like right up the street from Keithley, and like so basically between Keithley and Bird, and like I ended up living up the street from there too. And then like, you know, Audio Pack wasn't that far. I stayed within like the same like probably 5 mile radius within Cleveland. And you know, there's not a ton of tech in Cleveland, but I tried to hit all the ones that I knew there. So
nice.
Yeah. And I didn't learn any RF when I was there. That was what I was really getting at, because I've just learned anything about RF. I basically learned it much later. So
back to the electronics at uni thing. Just people don't realize how little electronics you actually learn in an electrical engineering course. Like, you know, you'd be surprised how little actual practical electronics you learn.
I was thinking about this recently too. Some of the things I wish I would have gotten deeper into that are like actually really interesting to me now were like the semiconductor physics classes. Like I think that's actually really interesting, but like they just pushed it soon.
It's fascinating.
It was based on the physics curriculum. It was like, oh, well, you got to know, you know, electrons and holes. It was like, what the hell is a hole? You know, you know, and you're totally right though. Like we didn't even get that stuff until, you know, almost junior year, like sophomore, junior year. It was like when they started doing that stuff. So I was there for 3 semesters before anything.
Yeah,
you know, I took more Japanese before I took, you know, electronics. So,
and there's huge variabilities in countries, in universities, within countries. It's just, you know, a massive variability. Like I learned civil engineering and mechanical engineering in the first year because, you know, it's in case you wanted to change. Right. Yep. Because, because most people coming in aren't like us. Right. They aren't hobbyists. Right. Although
I wasn't
a hobbyist.
Like you. Yeah. No,
you're one
lucky.
Of the strange ones who's. Yeah.
No, I'm one of the normal ones. I think you're one.
One of the normal ones, but strange in that you didn't have a hobby background before going in engineering at uni. And afterwards, you actually have a passion for it. That's rare.
I call that lucky. Yeah, I think the fact that I guessed in like my junior senior year of high school that I'm like, electronics sounds great. Like I like this. I think it'll be physicsy. I loved physics. Like, and I just got damn lucky, you know, like that really was that it stuck, right? Because I have friends that went in other directions or people that, you know, I have people that still don't know what they want to do, it, you know, in the mid 30s. So like, come on, like,
No, I still know EEs that, you know, had no hobby background, but they went and they did their EE degree and they're still working in EE, but like, they just, like, they're just meh. Like, don't care about it. They don't, you know, it's just a job to them.
Right.
Like, they don't, they wouldn't watch a single video or read a single thing outside of work. Mm. And even when they're inside of work, it's just getting the job done, you know?
Yeah. And some people
zero passion for it.
Right. But I also wonder, like, people like that too, like, I hope they find their thing at some point, but you know, some people just aren't into stuff like that. Like, they're just like, well, I just love fishing though. I want to go fishing. You know, like, that's the thing that I do. And it's like, yeah, well, you're not going to get paid to go, you know, very, very few people get paid to go fishing.
Exactly.
So yeah, I mean, like, it's just, you know, just kind of what tickles our neurons, I suppose.
Mm. And we happen to find a way to make a living from it. So, you know,
yeah.
Well, in my case, I made a full-time living from making educational YouTube videos, you know?
Right. Yeah, man.
How lucky is that? Jesus.
Yeah, it's a growing field, but it's still pretty narrow slice of the world.
Yep, there's not too many.
Here on the Amp Hour, we're working with sponsors who are interested in educating our listeners. Today, we're hearing again from Paul Galata from Mouser Electronics. And he's going to give some examples about how artificial intelligence, or AI, is doing good for the world. I asked Paul to start by defining AI.
Artificial intelligence is this ability to do this human-like capability of interacting with the world, receiving whatever the response are, and then adjusting in a positive direction and on our own, almost acting, if you will, under its own direction, even though it has this external programming where you're not looking for feedback from outside sources because it's happening so fast, you can't wait for the human. It just decides on its own, takes a measurement, sees, infers what it should do, makes the adjustments.
So how does this apply to the electronics world?
More recent developments include things like vision processing units or VPUs. There's processors now that are getting embedded with AI abilities inside of them so that you can go and develop and fine-tune and deploy convolutional neural networks, also called CNNs, to do things like real-time inferencing. This is an emulation of how human intelligence works, how human thinking does, where it goes in, looks at something, makes adjustments, gets feedback, and changes variables to improve towards a better output.
Could you tell me a little bit more about why Mouser is looking at this? This seems like a very, very high-level, broad topic.
Well, like I said, my job as a technology specialist is to look out into the future. Mouser is committing to being the distributor of electronic components and solutions that is at the cutting edge, at the forefront of all the technologies involved with electronics and associated technologies. We identified artificial intelligence several years ago as one of these very, very large macro trends. And so because of that, we are interested in all the changes that are afoot with our suppliers. We have a wide variety of ways that we can help people. That includes being able to provide technology products like embedded systems. An embedded system, a computer system, kind of a combination of a computer processor, some memory, input, output, peripheral devices and such, that has a dedicated function within a larger mechanical or electrical system. So we supply those solutions, which can be quite complicated.
To learn more about how Mouser Electronics is teaching their customers about artificial intelligence, check out theamphour.com/MouserAI. That's theamphour.com/MouserAI. You can download a free ebook all about artificial intelligence and learn how it might impact some of your future projects. And now back to the show.
I got my boards back. So speaking of things that I've been making videos about, so I made all my boards. I think maybe I mentioned it last time we talked, but I actually ended up treating myself over my vacation time, and I got my boards assembled, and they're back, and they're beauties.
By treating yourself, you meant you got them some other poor bastard to assemble them.
Oh,
for you.
Yeah. I paid for domestic expensive assembly. So
right. Were they machine assembled or hand assembled?
They were machine assembled. Yep.
Okay. Yep. Right. Yep. How much of a premium was that? And if you compare it to your time, let's say your time's let's make it an even $100 an hour.
Yeah. So I went with Screaming Circuits, who has been a past advertiser on the show. I should be, you know, upfront about that. No special, special price or anything like that. But I know Dwayne and I know the team there and I like what I've actually used them before. So good stuff. And I think it was about $250 a board, like in terms of assembly.
Yep.
So it was a little bit cheaper than I thought. It was going to be about 300, but I actually had counted wrong in terms of the number of parts that are like on the top and bottom, whatever.
Yeah.
And so about 250.
How did you count wrong? Your software spits out the bomb count.
What it really was, it's like, there's a bomb plugin for KiCad and it like, at the bottom, it says like 170 total components.
Yeah, I've used that bomb plugin. It's freaking awesome.
Yeah, it's great, right? And so it says 191, total components, and it said 71 uniques. And I was like, oh, great. So I went and plugged that into, Screamy Circuits. They basically do all their pricing based on that. And then like one of the people there, she emails me and she's like, you know that you only have 50 on here, right? I'm like, no, it says 71 at the bottom. And she's like, well, if you look at the rows, it's only, row 2 through 51. And
yeah. So I'm like,
oh, okay.
So what, is that a bug? What's the deal?
It ignores all the DNPs it takes out. And so I had a bunch of DNPs.
Oh,
and it says,
you had
there are
places.
71
okay.
total uniques, but you didn't put them all on here. So,
Oops.
Yeah. Well, it saved me a bunch of money, so that was nice.
Yeah. And they could probably put it on the one machine instead of in the single pass, because if a machine's only got 60 feeders, I've done a video on this, and you've got 61 parts, it's like, oops.
Yep.
Right? There's 61 unique parts, I mean.
Yeah, unique.
Like
right,
different parts, because every unique part has to have a reel in the machine, and the machine only has so many reels. So you've either got to put it through several series machines or put it through the same machine twice.
Yeah, so the proto service at Screaming Circuits is a little different. They actually do tape and reel, but they can do cut tape fine.
Right.
So they do like these fancy holders that are just like off to the side, and they basically they like index.
Oh, flat holders. So it's a lot of
exactly.
Right.
It's a little bit more hands on whatever, but it's real nice for that kind of stuff, and so you don't have to send in reels.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Or they don't have to re-reel them. If you buy those cut tapes from DigiKey, your assembler is going to be a bit miffed at you, because then they've got to get a reel, and they've physically then got to attach tape and like sticky tape, and then tape it in there and turn that cut tape back into a reel. So then they can put it, and it needs leader on it. So then they can put it into their pick and place machine, and they're going to charge you for that and be really.
They're going to charge you and just be like, well, go get a Mouser reel or Digi reel or whatever.
That's
the
Mouser or Digi reel does. That's why. Yeah. If you get a pick and place machine, don't buy the cut tape. There's three options at DigiKey and Mouser and Element 14 and all that. Element 14 do reels? Do they like do the Digi reel equivalent?
I think so. I haven't used them in a while.
I've never bought one from them. I bought them from Mouser and DigiKey. But anyway, there's three options. You can buy a full reel, which, you got to buy like 4,000, however many parts it is, like 4,000 or something like that.
Yeah. 20,000 if it's an 0201 reel.
Or if you're lucky... somebody on Twitter posted this. I can't remember who it was, but I think I retweeted and commented that they got all this packaging. They bought like two chips from DigiKey, and they got all this packaging. Like they were in our trays, right? These giant trays. And they sent them these giant trays for their two chips. And they wondered, this is wasteful. It's like, well, you're the one who ordered the last two chips. So you got stuck with the packaging garbage, they would have had to throw out. So they just ship it in the giant tray because you ordered the last two chips. So it's the same with the reel. If you get lucky and there's 850 parts left on that reel and you order 850, they'll ship you the whole reel. Usually.
That's right.
That's okay. Or you can choose a Digi reel or a Mouser reel, which is they will actually cut off and then re-reel. They'll do that job that your assembler would have done for you. And I think it's $8 a reel.
Seven last I looked, but it might be up to $8 now. Yeah.
And the third is cut tape, which you just get the tape. They pull it off and they cut it and they give it to you.
You got to put like some wastage on there too. So like,
oh, you
got to
put wastage. So
you got to
order. Yep. 5%, 10% depends on the, which can add up. If you've got an expensive resistor, if you know, if you've got a 30-cent resistor and you need, you know, a dollar resistor, it's a real precision jobby.
Yep. Yeah. I was calculating the total cost on all this stuff, and like the prototypes are about $500 prototypes at the end of the day.
Each board.
Each board, yeah. Yeah, so like the assembly costs, the boards, the parts, and the real stinker that I always forget about, but always gets me. So I have some Quicktel modems on there, right? So they've got cellular modems. And like the real stinker of it is like I got 5 modems, and for some reason Quicktel only ships on a courier account, fine, whatever, but they only ship overnight international.
Modem.
Like a cellular, it's like a module that basically is, can talk to a cell tower.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about like a dial-up modem.
Yeah, sorry, I'd use that term interchangeably. They're much smarter than just a modem, but like basically it's a cell tower interface chip effectively, right? So, but you just talk to it over a serial, right? So like if you have you worked with cell modems modules before either?
Yes, I have. It's like a serial in, RF out, magic happens, serial back out the other end. It's magic. You know, it's a wireless serial link, basically.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and it's like, that's also how XB modules work too. Like they're just like these, you know, usually they're, well, in the case of cellular modules, if you're using the serial and you don't have it mapped as a certain type of data port, it's usually just AT commands, right? Literally like AT plus,
I've used these so many times in wireless production test gear because it's just so easy. Because it's so easy to implement like a serial port in your microcontroller, right? And code. It's just like it's really easy. And then you don't have to muck around with the RF. You buy these modules and it's like you're connecting two things with a physical serial cable. So
that's right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of crap in between, but yeah, it can be as nice as that if it works out. And I don't remember where I was going with that, but
you're mentioning that like availability.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Modems shipping. Versus modules versus shipping. So like, the modules were like 15, you know, the production price is going to be like $8-$10, something like that. But it's, so it's more for low volume, fine, whatever. But then another like $100 in shipping just for these 5 modems to come to the US. Yep. And then I have to bounce them back out to, you know, the assembler. And so it's like, oh, well, that's actually like, okay, now it's like a $30 modem, like, you know, instead of a 15. And like, like that just really ups the cost and, you know, like all of the overhead stuff. And like, so in the same case of like, if you had to do digi reels, $7 per reel doesn't sound that bad in single quantities. But if you have 50 uniques and you need 50 digi reels, that's another $350 on top. And then it's like, okay, well now we're talking some real money here, you know, like it's really
exactly
so
did that eat into your profit or did you pass the charge on to the customer client?
Dave, I am the customer.
Oh, I thought this was for a client job.
No, this is very different for me. So this is the board that I've been designing for Contextual Electronics.
Contextual Electronics board, right.
Right. Got it. So it's, I'm going to put it maybe on Tindy at some point, but right now it's just in test phase. But the idea is basically it's a starter board.
Yeah,
you've seen it, right. So it's basically it's like a starter board for all of future clients of like, you know, it's got a cell modem, it's got Bluetooth, it's got all the power handling, all that stuff. It's got interface. And then I can just slap a daughter card onto it and it basically just becomes whatever the daughter card is. That's kind of the idea.
Right.
Yeah. So,
awesome. So it was worth, so you were, are you going to continue to do that? Because, I didn't have to assemble that bastard. And I shouldn't have picked 0402s. It's like when you're assembling hand assembly, you're going, oh, I shouldn't have picked 0402s.
You know, it's interesting. The 0402 thing, I'm okay with that mostly.
You're okay with it?
My eyes are still doing okay with that.
So do you do it by eye or do you use a lamp? Do you use like a Maggie lamp or something?
I don't know. I still, as long as I have good lighting, I can still do it by hand.
Right. Okay.
And since I mostly cut out caffeine out of my life, like my hands are much steadier than they used to be.
Right.
So that part's been okay. It, you know, it's a lot of time and, you know, you can get more dense so you have a lot more parts. Yeah, no, I think that part's okay.
Would you reflow those or would you individually hand solder?
The 0402s in general?
Oh, just the whole board. Like, would you actually do a stencil and reflow it?
I would. So the real reason I ended up sending aside from the timing working out where I wanted to treat myself while I was away, there is this stinker of a part on the NRF52840. It's a AQFN. So it's like basically like two rows of BGA with like a huge center pad. And I'm really nervous about it.
No, so, that's just evil. Yeah.
Yeah. If I have access to an X-ray in the future, I might be a little bit more confident about it. But yeah, I was
well,
like,
that's something you have to reflow. Like you can't hand solder that. Like,
oh, that's right. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
No, you can. Like I've done a video where these sorts of packages, you can actually, if it's got a thermal pad, that's really handy because then you can drop vias down to the bottom side. You can have a big exposed pad on the bottom. Then you can get your soldering iron on the bottom side and then heat that up. And then that will actually then flow through the bond wires and actually heat up the, heat up the pads around it under the chip. So
and you can do it if you have like a board preheater too. I feel like that's
a board preheater. It helps. You
just pre-tin all the pads, and then you just kind of put a shitload of flux on there, and you know, pray. And but the thing was, I didn't want to do that on the first one, right? I want to make sure that I haven't made other stupid mistakes first.
Just send it to an assembler.
Yeah.
Let them do it properly.
Another interesting thing. So, like looking at domestic versus international, you know, overseas. And like, Dave, let me tell you, man, like it's like I said, I love Screaming Circuits. Like they were great, but like PCBWay was like, I got a quote. It was like, I think $30 instead of 300. It was like a 10X difference. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, and it's just, and I didn't want to, at the time I was like, I don't really want to deal with, you know, like sending parts overseas, worrying about customs, like, you know, like timing issues, whatever.
And there's a big issue with delays at the moment and things, you know. Yeah.
Right. And so, like, it wasn't worth it for me this time, but, like, in the future, you know, like, okay, if I've got, like, a bunch more time and I've got the design ironed out, like, you know, I could go there. I could go to a bunch of other places internationally. That's not a big deal, so.
But if you're passing the cost on to a client, I'd go local because you can.
Well, again, I am the client, Dave, so if...
You know, yeah, but I'm saying, but you've also got your side business doing client stuff, right?
Oh, sure.
So, you know.
Yeah, I don't think it's an underhanded, like passing it off, right? Like it's a true quality, you know, communication, turnaround times kind of thing. Mm. Like, you know, I think, yeah, you're right. It's worth paying that premium until you need to go, you know, high volume. So. And even high volume, you could probably find some stuff domestically. It's just not the services that I was, you know, you know, none of the Tempo or, you know, Circuit Hub or all any of those, you know, PCB
and
NG.
This reminds me of a link you sent me like a couple of weeks ago. You sent me, oh, look at this. Oh, this looks sexy as. And it's a $4,000 hand pick and place machine. It's like,
wait, when?
It's got.
I sent you this?
Yeah, no. I'm sure it was you.
I don't
I'm
think
sure
so, Dave.
It was you. No, sorry. I'm mistaken. it was David. It was my former employee, David.
Oh, okay. Which kind of... Yep. No worries. Yeah, that's great. What's it about?
I'll see if I can... Hang on. I'll see if I can find it. Hang on. Okay. Hang on.
So we have one of those. There's one of those at M-Hub, and the... downside to it. So the interesting thing is like it's got like a table that like kind of helps smooth out your motion and stuff like that for doing hand pick and place. And it's got like a rotation. It's basically got a small suction element. Basically it's like a true pick and place where it's got a suction element, but the needle's not that good. And like, I don't know, like it doesn't seem it's a ManCorp. That's the one that I've used.
Yeah. This one is, I just sent you the link. It's is a Fortex.
Okay.
Fortex. And it's a manual picker. You would think, looking at it, oh, that looks like a simple pick and place machine. And it kind of is, because it's got like real type things. It's even got like, tubes. You can put the tubes of parts in there and stuff like that.
And stuff like
It's got like, you know, 16 feeders on it or something. And then, but it's basically an XY table with like this manual, like it's got a thumb press on the top. And then that activates the suction thing.
Oh, cool.
And then you basically just move it, so you're using your arm is the pick and place machine, so you move it over, put it over the part
controller.
Press the button, suction, and you know, human it's like, you know, and for hand placing, it's, you know, if you just want to get the job done then and there, you don't want to dick around programming and loading a machine, then it's, you know, but that's as niche as it gets. I mean, really. And it's like $4,000.
Yeah, I think so. Also, if you're making a machine like this, wouldn't you show like something smaller than a SOIC-16? It's like, man, that's not the hard ones, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I know it's actually because of like the photo, and it's like it's easy to show, but yeah.
Yeah. And there will be a lot of people out there, the aficionados of do-it-yourself pick-and-place machines, going like, why does this thing even exist? You know, if you go into that sort of effort, just put a motor on there and a camera, and it's a pick-and-place machine, right? And a pump.
Like, I totally get like the draw to the pick-and-place. So I talked to Stephen Hawes, who was building his own DIY one. He was on the Contextual Electronics podcast. And like, he's building a DIY one, and I love following his progress. And he's like, you know, he's kind of like building up his skills too. So he's like been like building more and more interesting equipment too. And like, he even says, he's like, look, this isn't really, you know, he's doing it for the project. He doesn't, you know, he wants a pick and place machine eventually, but like, it's still, if there was a way that it actually programmed itself easily, well then a lot of people are out of jobs, I think, because that would be the Ark of the Covenant.
He's being realistic.
Like
he's being realistic he totally is. And is admitting that it's a neat toy, but it's not really that practical.
Yeah, right. Well, and he's like improving over time.
There's like niche uses, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think that like, I think the example he gave was like, he wants to be able to like turn it on when he goes to bed, and he like comes back and a couple boards are done. And like that is totally a achievable goal, I think. And like,
oh, it's achievable, but how much time and effort you put into doing that is,
yeah, but like again, if it's low cost enough, then too, you can maybe have a couple of them, you know, like, and it, you know, there's always these it is going to be corner cases, of course, but like, you know, but for a makerspace, it might make sense. And for, you know, his situation makes sense. And like I said, I totally get the draw, because like I said, I spent 5 hours today hunched over a board. And if a machine could have done that, I was actually sitting right next to a machine that in theory could have done that, but I didn't want to, I don't mess around. I've made that mistake.
I keep going back to the classic example for having your own pick and place machine. Mike from Mike's Electric Stuff, right? Because his niche is designing LED things, right? These large, like, you know, meter long boards and all sorts of all sorts of stuff, right? And they've just got thousands and thousands of LEDs on them, and he literally reuses everything. So his pick and place machine is just permanently loaded with all the stuff all the parts he needs. Like he uses the same microchip pick that he's been for the last 15-20 years, you know.
He upgraded. Yeah, he's on a PIC 32 now, I think.
Oh, he's on PIC 32. Yeah. Okay, well, I stand corrected. Anyway, so he's...
I'm sure he still has the PIC 16 in there, too.
Right,
you know,
16,
right. PIC 18, whatever.
Yeah. And anyway, so he's like... And he's got all these just permanently loaded his machine, and when a new client comes along, because it's all word of mouth, right? So when a new client comes around, I need this new arty-farty LED thing, he goes, yep, no worries. It's got to have, you know, 10 million LEDs on it, and I'll have it to you by next week. The reason he can do it is because everything's in place, all the infrastructure's in place, all these, you know, all these schematic footprint components, they're all tied into the machine. He's written scripts to automatically program it, and, you know, all sorts of stuff. It's just highly automated because he's in that one niche. Whereas if he suddenly went to, you know, designing other types of boards for other clients that do totally different things, it all starts falling apart, right?
Yep, totally. Yeah. We need to come up with an excuse to get, I mean, not that you need an excuse, but we need a reason to have Mike back on, because we haven't talked to him.
You're right,
too long.
Yes. Yeah, you know, like, yep, absolutely. Yeah. So we can, extol the virtues of his pick and place machine again.
Just pick his brain, really. I mean, like, love talking to that guy.
Yep. I think he's currently working on a meter wide board or something.
Oh, my God.
On Twitter. It's like, he's got these weird ass, because all these arty farty things, they have to be weird ass, right?
That's right. Yeah. 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 If it's not different, why are they doing it?
Yeah. You know, no, he's like signage. The only one in the UK who's ever made like a meter long board, and he had to find a specific board house that could do it, you know? And it's like, it's just crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I posted his, he did a teardown recently of an underwater radio. I thought that was kind of close to your
space.
Yeah, that's pretty fun.
Yes, I've, had a dabble in that.
It was interesting, the point he made about the connectors kind of self-sealing with like the, from the pressure of the water. I thought that was an interesting point. I never really thought about that.
Yeah, no, but that works in the underwater marine seismic thing. That's why they're all rubberized. They're all a vulcanized rubber or whatever. Okay. I don't know the exact, you know, type, but when they mate together, it forms it. You know, you often, before you put these connectors together, you'll actually grease them up, right? So you'll fill it full of, like, you know, grease gel type stuff, and then you'll slam the connectors together and the rubber just, you know, completely forms a watertight seal.
Right.
It's just,
right.
Yeah, it's great. So
there was a talk that one of the things I used to host, I'm sure I mentioned it before, but it was back in 2017, and it was Nick Bingham, and he talked about, like, super, super deep dive. Like, he was working on the stuff with James Cameron, like the Marianas Trench stuff. I'm sure I mentioned it on the show before, but I'll bring it up again. And, like, hearing about, like, the stuff that you need to think about with, like capacitors imploding, like, just, like, the pressures around components.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's just stuff that, like, is so corner case for electronics in general. It was a really interesting talk, so I'll post that in the notes too. I always think about that.
Yep.
Because they were making custom things too.
If you've got a air or moisture bubble trapped inside your quad flat pack, are screwed. Right. That thing's going to explode. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, as the pressure
implode
up,
probably.
So, or implode or whatever. Yeah, no, it's going to do something bad. Something bad's going to happen.
That's bad.
It's going to ruin your day, and somebody's going to die at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
it's serious business.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
Yeah. Probably even more so than space. Like really
space goes the other
deep
direction,
underwater.
Right?
Well, because, like, pressure is, space is like just cold vacuum. You can deal with that. Right, dealing with pressure's hard.
Yeah,
like keeping pressure out is like at the bottom
of
the ocean.
It goes to infinity, right? I mean, like, it can keep going to higher and higher levels, right? Whereas, like, once you're at vacuum, you're at vacuum. You know, like, not that space is easy. Don't get us wrong here.
No, I can remember many hours spent hunched over a pressure vessel. We used to have giant pressure vessels, like, I'm talking like a meter wide, so, you know, 3 foot wide or something, 4 foot wide.
Yep,
pressure vessels, and all of our equipment would, you know, you'd have like custom racks built in there to like put your equipment in, and then you'd have proper penetrators to get like test signals in and out and stuff like that. And these giant, you know, hydraulic pressure vessels, and, you know, you'd stand back, you'd close the gate, and the big arm, it'd come down, then it'd seal, and then these big locking, you know, things, and it would go down to like, you know, 2,000 meters pressure and stuff like that. And these things were serious bits of kit. If you didn't use them right, you could kill yourself.
Oh, totally.
You know, it's
the interns weren't allowed to play with that one, I bet.
you had to go through the training course, and and just testing stuff, underwater pressure stuff is like, you know, it's really a big deal. So even when you go down like a couple of hundred meters, it start getting serious pressure, right? Yeah. Right.
What kind of pressures would they see it at, like, a couple hundred meters?
Oh, I can't remember how many, 10 bar or something.
Okay.
Rings a bell. This is 25 years ago. This is like 20 years ago now. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, this was mid-90s kind of thing. What's 20 bar in meters? 10 bar in meters.
My brain thinks in PSI, which is real dumb.
101 meters is 10 bars. There you go. That's right. A bar every 10 meters, roughly.
Oh, okay. Of course, metric would make sense like that. Yeah.
Although it's not spot on. It's 101.97. So 10 bar to 101.97. So
is there something with atmospheres too, or no? Isn't like atmospheres the SI unit? I don't remember.
Oh, I don't know. But anyway, one bar is 10.2
like a water column.
Exactly. So it's so long ago.
Why do engineering students spend the first 2 years learning about other stuff?
I'm
just thinking back to physics class. I'm like, oh, this is all SI
but you wouldn't learn bars in
didn't remember it, so like, who cares?
Right.
To go back to that real quick, there are some programs that do like auditing of like different fields and like electronics and stuff like that. And they'll do like small project type stuff. Obviously, this is going to be Chris talking about how he loves project-based education. But I think that's great just to like go out and try a bunch of, like, Olin is one that I think of course. Olin Olin College is like one of the best experiential education for engineering, I think. But like they do like an auditing course, I believe, and there's some other schools that do auditing courses in early ones. So again, if you're a student,
what does auditing course mean? What is
so
that?
Like they would do like a project course where it would be like go build, you know, a little Bluetooth thingy, you know, use an Arduino, right? And that would be like a college course, right? For people that have never done it before, they're like,
right,
just see if you a little bit.
Right, but why is it called auditing?
Because you'd be like, you'd be trying out these different things. You'd also maybe go and design something in a mechanical, you know, auditing all these different fields.
That just seems
like
a weird use of the word. Yeah, I totally get it, but that sounds
That might be my vocab that's wrong.
It's
like, it's basically, you know, you're basically trying out all these different fields. It's like it's like a poo-poo platter or a smorgasbord of different engineering disciplines.
Yeah. Hang on. You can't just drop poo-poo platter in the middle of the amp hour and not get questions. What's a poo-poo platter?
Poo-poo platter was like the multi-dish platter that like Chinese American restaurants. I'm sure it's not ethnically correct, but
right,
like it was like the smorgasbord of like if you went to like a Chinese American restaurant,
right?
Like the poo-poo platter would be like a little bit of everything, you know. P-U-P-U. Make sure I'm looking this up right. But
oh,
I just always
okay, not P-O-O. Oh, okay, yeah. Right. So poo, like poo is like a Chinese word or something. Right?
A typical
okay.
poo-poo platter, as found in American Chinese cuisine, might include an egg roll, spare ribs, chicken wings, chicken fingers, beef teriyaki, skewered beef, fried wontons, crab rangoon, and fried shrimp. All of which are like not Chinese food. Like
right, of course.
This is like
it's
Americanized Chinese.
Americanized, yeah.
Deep fried. Just like, have you ever had crab rangoon before? Do you know what that is?
No, I have no idea.
It's basically like fried dough around like fake crab and like cream cheese. I don't know how it
so
became
American.
A thing.
Sounds very American.
It sounds
delicate.
Like something you would eat at like a, you know, like an Arkansas like state fair. You know, like people eat that up around here. Let me tell you. I have not had really, really bad Chinese food, like American Chinese food, in a long time.
Yeah.
But this makes like this is like a callback. I gotta go.
Right.
Yeah. It's real bad. Oh boy. Yeah.
Oh boy. Yeah. There's gonna be
platter.
Lots of comments from our Asian audience, I'm sure.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, it's Chinese American food. It's not like this is not. I do not even come close to saying that this is a true Chinese
food.
No,
we have Australian Chinese and Australian Thai. If you go to a Thai restaurant here, it's not Thai food. It's Australianized Thai.
Exactly. I mean, it's all fast food anyway, right? It's like it's delicious and it's deep fried and
Wow, we learned something new here on the amp hour today.
Poo-poo platter.
Poo-poo platter.
At least I got it right. I was worried. I was as you were laughing, and I was like, "Oh crap! Did I say this wrong?"
Oh boy!
Yeah.
It sounds like something that my kids would say, you know, because like boys are into, you know, eight-year-old boys are into.
This
poo-poo.
Tastes like a poo-poo platter.
Exactly.
But, you know, you can teach that to them, and now they're gonna love you for it. You know?
Because everything's a poo joke. Everything's a fart joke. Everything's a bum joke. You know, like
Totally. Yep. Yep, that's about the age my nephews are at too, and very similar.
Yes.
Yep.
I think that's pretty universal around the world. Poo and bum jokes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's still kind of funny at my age.
Of course. And then that's when your wife just rolls their eyes. You know.
That's right. Yep.
Yep. Yep. Mm. You newly married person. You.
That's right. Right. Got a wife now.
Congratulations, by the way.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Ball and
if
chain.
If you want to. It's well, I know I was told I was not supposed to ever refer to her as that, so
I'm in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a real good time. We hiked all over, you know, social distance national park kind of thing, and got to hike some amazing trails, saw some glaciers.
Excellent.
Yeah,
really, I saw the photos.
Yeah, I'll post the Instagram link if people are interested. Lots of, you know, mountain ranges and fuzzy goats.
I don't follow you
like
on
that.
Instagram.
Yep.
I think I only follow like two people on Instagram. It's like I do use Instagram now. I'm actually trying to post. There's still no one program that really posts to both at the same time, Instagram and Twitter. So I post them differently because they're I don't know. They're in some war. I don't know.
Whatever. They don't work together. Fine. Yeah.
Yeah, their APIs don't work or something. Yeah. Anyway.
Yep.
Hmm.
We are running out of time, but I did want to mention KaiCon is kind of happening this year. It's a little different. I'm going to be hosting all the developers. So there's like 12 developers now, which is great. And we're just going to have like 2 1-hour conversations just about kind of what's next. And, and there will be some announcements and, you know, people can show up and ask questions and stuff like that. So that's coming up on October 3rd. So if people are interested, there's a sign up on the KaiCon page, which I will link in, and, you know, you can watch it after the fact too. It's no big deal. But if you want to participate live, there's also a hashtag on Twitter. I forget what it is, but I will post it here. If you want to ask questions about V6, which is coming. So
excellent.
Lots of fun stuff coming. I noticed cool you were, groovy. Did you use KiCad again for something recently?
Yes, I used it for something recently. I wanted to have a little bit of a rant about that, if I may, shortly.
Sure.
Quickly.
Maybe I could bring it up on the KaiCon, you know?
See, because I knew that DigiKey had released a KiCad.
The library, yeah.
Library, right? So right. I thought, oh, right, because I needed specific, right? I just wanted footprints because I was doing that demo thing. Right, I was doing that demo video, you know, the 3 ways to fail at PCB design.
Is this the one where it was the unnamed person who was me?
Yes, the unnamed person who was maybe you.
It was definitely me.
Right.
At first, I was kind of like upset about it. I was like, well, you know, it's good. It's teaching other people. And yeah.
Exactly. It's like, all right. Chill out. Yeah.
I'm learning.
You weren't named specifically, you know. Anyway. Well, we talked about it on the show, for goodness sake, didn't we?
I mean, yeah, we did. You know.
Anyway, so, yeah, so I thought, because I needed a specific footprint, right? I needed specific, BGA footprints, and I thought I'd use KiCad just because, you know. And so I thought, I'll just download this. And, like, I realized that the DigiKey, it was hard to install. It wasn't easy to install that library. It wasn't true. You can't just go install library. Like, it's not, I had to put it in
you
got
to download it, and then you got to find it and put it in the right place.
And I, that was annoying.
It gets easier over time, but yeah, that's still totally a weakness. That's probably the number one thing that's brought up as a weakness.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Library management is just tough. It's getting a little better in V6, but it's still
the same. Yeah. Anyway, so I found that annoying, especially for some. Yeah, as you said, if you're used to it, you know exactly what to do. But I had to go and read tutorials on how to do it. Like,
there's a video about how to install the DigiKey library. Just so you know.
Oh, I think I might have even looked at that or something.
Yep.
Anyway, so I installed that and then I realized, it's not all the parts. I thought, all the parts,
and they're all atomic too. That's the other thing. So like, because you need to attach. So atomic being like one footprint. One symbol, one 3D model, right? Instead of having the Altium or the KiCad way of doing it where they're decoupled from one another, because in DigiKey, you want to have it where, you know, it's a specific part. So I'm putting down an LM317 ABCD, and then, there's also an LM317 DEFG, right? And it's like, those are actually different footprints. So you need to actually have two different, completely different things that are separate in the layout program and the schematic program.
Yep. Right. Anyway, I was disappointed that it didn't have everything. I thought, I'll start using KiCad. And because it's got all the DigiKey parts, it's magic. It's under like 1,000 parts or something.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's manually made by some of the DigiKey engineers.
Which is great, right? It's manually made. But then I just I was kind of like deflated. I went, oh.
Yeah.
You know,
Yep.
Yep. Yep. And of course, guaranteed by the laws of Murphy.
The one you wanted was not there. of course.
Guaranteed, right? Yeah, you know, it's I was really let down by that. So
yeah, that is rough.
So I was let down twice. I was let down by the difficulty in installing the library and then the fact that library only had like 1,000 parts.
So there is a BGA generator, if that is easier for you in the future.
Right, yes. That would have been much easier. That would have been the thing that...
And it's a really weird spot too. It's like
I think I tried to look. I thought there might have been a component generator. I tried to look for it, and I couldn't find it. Is it in a weird place? Is it?
It's not. Well, it's just not labeled well. So it's like right. So if you pull up the, I think it's the footprint maker. So you have to go to the footprint. Oh, my computer's locking up now. Of course.
I think I tried to use the footprint maker, and I went in and couldn't find it immediately. So I ditched.
Yeah.
It.
Yep. Yeah. I mean that's how it goes, right?
Right.
Yeah, and then once you're in there, then there's like a way to do, you know, different BGA parts. You can generate other things. I'm not sure if they're JEDEC based or I'm not sure if they're standard like that or anything like that, but they work okay. Oh, here we go. Yeah, so if you go into the footprint editor, there's new library, add library, new footprint, create footprint, and create footprint is the one that is the, that's the actual generator. And it's like, no, that should just be a, it should say generator or something like that. So there's BGA, okay, circular pad, FPC, stuff like that. So,
okay, yeah, cool. Yeah. Right. All right. I just didn't look hard enough, I guess.
I mean, that's a tough thing to find, honestly. So,
right. Okay.
Yeah. Good. There is a new SnapEDA. Friends over at SnapEDA just announced they have a plugin now too. So I've been using Snap once in a while. And yeah, there's not just Snap. There's EE Librarian. There's Ultra Librarian, or EE Concierge rather. I think is what is their names? The ones who got bought by Altium. They make
Upverter. Is it?
Yeah, Upverter. They had a generator as well. They had you could pay to get them generated. And like when I started, we talked about this a little bit with the getting the board assembled. Like it's like 20, 30 bucks for a part. Now it's like, oh man. Like you really start to do the math, and you're like, yeah, that from a time wise perspective, it's a complicated enough part. And if they guarantee it, it's like, yeah. And if it's gonna have a 3D model too, like that actually, okay, maybe. And there's a bunch of services like this out there now. So it's like,
yep.
I like that. Yeah. I still haven't like gotten into that flow, but I know some people who like professionally, they just kind of like have an account and they're just like, all the different ones out there.
Bam, bam, bam.
And they just click and they come back, in a couple hours the next day and it's ready to go. It's like, Oh,
I totally would have done. Well, we did have that like at Altium internally, we would be like we do a lot of libraries ourselves, but the 3D models, right? Because we were like the 3D model the 3D model thing was kind of new at the time. So we had to, all our parts had to be precisely 3D modeled and everything. Right. So we'd have mechanical engineers that did that. We'd have library people who specialized in making 3D models. And it was like, oh, that was great. So you just, send them the number and they'd, and bingo, an hour later came back your nice 3D model and you just whack that in your part and beautiful.
That's real nice. I've gotten very comfortable with, very dependent upon 3D models. And
Why can whoever's in charge of putting together the build for KiCad, can they just get all the latest libraries like KiCad and these Snap EDAs and just get all the biggies out there and just bundle them with the stock install? That'd be nice.
The latest build pulls in the GitHub controlled official KiCad library. So there are librarians now, and so it does pull that in.
But can they also pull in the big ones, like the the seed ones and the doesn't JLC have one as well? There's all these companies, all these like assembly and distribution companies that have all these libraries. So it'd be nice if they were all in core, or at least half a dozen of them. Don't get every tin pot one, but at least get all the major ones everyone's heard of, kind of thing. So
I think I'm not very up to date on the V6 what's coming, but one thing that I did talk to Seth and Wayne about, I think there's a marketplace coming. And so I think that might be like a click to install kind of thing that's on the way. And that actually might be the best solution in the future, where it's just like, oh, I want the SnapEDA thing, click. Oh, I want the, the seed library, click. Yeah, that would be the best case scenario. So yeah, I'll ask about that though. That is a good idea. I mean,
that'd be fantastic. Like,
Having that like centralized system where it's just, you don't have to, maybe don't pull everything. Cause I think the KiCad libraries are like 6 or 7 gigs, but being able to
at least have if there's a like third party menu option or something like that just says import, and then the links might get broken eventually, but you just keep that up to date. So I want to install
that's on the company that you're pulling from.
Plugin. Please install the DigiKey plugin, one click and boom.
That's always great. That is always the balance point of like something that's like open source, but like, still centralized, and like, there's always that push pull of that. But I think ease of use kind of, that's, I think, a great power of Altium, right? Is like that it is, if you buy into that ecosystem, you're like, you're there, you just have it, and it's, you're good to go. So.
Yep. But I think that's one of the features that everyone could agree is like useful for almost everyone. Like being able to call in libraries.
Yeah. No, I want to do this. I'd like to spend my weekends, please. And I think some people are like, well, I don't want to like depend on someone else and like get something messed up. But I understand that is like a risk aversion. But I don't think that people are like, really particular about their wanting to like, oh, no, I need to have my own line widths. They have to be perfect. So the kerning on my text has to be really, really good.
Yeah. All right. Can we finish off the show with a bench of the week?
Sure. Is this the one that was in the background of your...
No.
That was a great bench.
You're being stuck into the mindset of electronics benches.
Oh,
what about optical benches?
Ooh, optical bench. What does that mean?
It's in our list. It's in our list. Have a look at it. Okay. The optics table from hell. This was posted on Twitter by a Dr. Carls Brown. He's a physicist. He's a physicist at UC Berkeley, postdoc, Yale, PhD. Anyway.
Doesn't sound very smart.
What?
I said he doesn't sound very, he sounds very, very smart. That's what I was saying.
Right.
Berkeley, Yale, Brown, like all these things.
Anyway, he posted this image on Twitter of the optics table from hell. It's got optics tables on top of optics tables with vertical optics tables.
This is insane.
And he didn't build all this. It's like being built by various students over the years, and they just... It's like the Holy Grail. You do not touch it.
This is like the Jim Williams of optic tables.
Yeah. This is the Jim Williams of optic tables.
Wow, that is so awesome. What does one use an optics table? This is for like building setups for like bending light and stuff like that?
Yes,
like
bending light, filtering light. So yeah, it's all to do with, you know, various measurements of different types, and you've got to bend them, filter them, split them, recombine them, you know, and for various like physics experiments and things like that.
Wow.
So yeah, I think in the Twitter thread he does actually go through and explain what some of it does, I think. But it's just it's insane.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, an optics table is basically a real ridiculously heavy, like couple of hundred kilo metal table that is like precisely machined flat.
Yeah.
And it doesn't move. It's got anti-vibration feet. It doesn't vibrate. It's like, you know, so this huge stable physical metal platform that just has a whole bunch of machined threaded holes all over it. It's like Swiss cheese.
It's like a pegboard, but basically like horizontal.
It's like a pegboard for and then you screw in all of your optics, lasers, your lenses, your beam splitters, your beam combiners, your measurement things, and then so you bounce lasers all around these tables. I'm sure you've seen it in like movies and whatnot,
right.
You know,
weird science. Bum, ba, dum, bum, bum.
Yeah, it allows you to get in there and just tweak. Oh, I want to move that filter in and out, so you can physically just drop it in and out, and
that is super cool. Do you know what the spacing is on those tables? Like, is it like a standard like 10 centimeters or something like that? Or
I got no idea between the holes. It looks like maybe an inch or something. I don't know. Oh no, maybe less. I don't know. I'm sure there is a standard.
Yeah. Perhaps. Whatever it is, I'm sure there's a metric and an imperial and. They argue about that too.
Yep. I'm sure they do. Our optic brethren.
You know, every time someone brings up, so like Jerry Ellsworth would always talk about optics with, you know, like when she was explaining like the, you know, the VR, AR kind of stuff too. And like, it is like a whole other world to me. And we've had one or two other people on the show who've talked about it. But man, I just like, I don't get it. I gotta like dig into that at some point. It seems like a very expensive thing to get into, but it's
It's a very expensive hobby.
Well, someday.
Yes, my Phil, my brother-in-law, patent attorney, brother-in-law. He's an optical physicist. That's what he got his PhD in. Physics, and he wants an optics table in his home. Yeah. But the wife, I think, has vetoed the optics table. So,
what are you going to use it for?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I just want to play with lasers and shit. Right.
I'll find a use eventually.
That was not a compelling enough reason. I just want to play with lasers and shit.
Yep. Oh my God.
didn't fly. I'm afraid. So,
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll have to ping Dr. Brown here and see if there's a reason for him to be on the show. That might be interesting to hear from him. Wow.
That's nuts.
That's a great photo.
I love it. And it's also packed in too. Anyway.
Oh yeah.
Done.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. All right.
That's it.
Well, talk to you next time. No, wait, I say something else. What do I say? I'll see you later.
You don't know. Catch you next time. We'll be right back.
keep on zapping.
After all these years, you still haven't got an outro right.
Electrons, ho.
Oh, God.
The current be flowing.
Why do I feel like Julian Banjos are about to come into...
Zippity, zippity, zippity. All right.